Pappas Pilar is a spirit that embodies adventure. Named after the late great Ernest Hemingway and his boat, the Pilar, the name says it all. This ultra-premium blended rum is hand-selected from around the Caribbean and blended by master blender Ron Call. After a long day on the water, when the sun is descending the sky, end on a good note with Pilar by your side. Go support them at PappasPilar.com or a liquor store near you. Whether on the boat, on the river, or in the woods, Yeti products are by our side. There are many innovative first-class companies in the outdoor market today, but none more so than Yeti. In 2006, they took the industry by storm when they produced their first roto-molded cooler that was reliable and built for the wild. 17 years later, with a multitude of new products, they continue to raise the bar and be the gold standard for all outdoor brands. We couldn't be more proud to have them as a Millhouse sponsor and a family member. Al DePerrick has been one of the most insightful and successful guides to ever fish the fabled Homosassa water, where all the biggest tarpon swam for decades. He and his anglers caught some of the largest tarpon ever caught on a fly. His story is one we've been hunting down for 2 years. If you like chasing big fish, you don't want to miss this one.
We broke everything. We broke lines. We broke hooks. We broke rods. We broke our minds. We broke marriages. We broke the whole thing.
We came up with the idea of going out that night and chasing girls, and whoever had the biggest pair of panties won the pot.
I knocked another arrow, and he turned around the other way, and I shot him going through the other way, so I double-lunged him both ways.
But it was nothing for us to paddle an air mattress out into Government Cut.
I got him on. All right, now we're going to teach him a lesson.
I'm just an old guy that likes to fish. I'm not quitting yet.
And he said, well, who the hell do you think you are, Sue App? And I said, that's exactly who I am.
Life's journey to the grave should not be one arriving with a pretty, well-preserved body, but rather skid in broadside in a cloud of smoke, thoroughly torn out, thoroughly used up, proclaiming wildly, wow, what a ride.
There's something fishy going on here.
I didn't even know all the superlatives that would represent this podcast, mm-hmm. how great you are, what you've done in the world of fishing, especially in Homosassa. Everybody I've ever spoken to holds you in the highest regard as a captain, your fish abilities, as a commercial fisherman, mm-hmm. as a world record chaser. And I'm just so glad that you're willing to come onto the podcast and tell your story. I know that we were trying to get it. Well, one of our first podcasts were with the three of the greatest fishermen of all time, yourself, Dean Butler, yeah. and Tom Evans. Mm-hmm. It was raw.
And very,
it was real.
Very.
it was hairy. After that, we tried to get you a couple of years ago, and the last minute it kind of fell through, and then you called me. Recently, you said, hey, I'm ready to do this podcast. What made you jump on?
Well, honestly, it's because I started thinking about all the favors you did for me back in the day. Mm. When I would call you, I think you were with Outdoor Life, maybe?
I was with the Outdoor Life Network.
Okay.
The TV
well, anyhow,
show, and, yeah, and some magazines.
I'd call you, I took you fishing, and you said, hey, if you ever need any tickets to do anything, let me know. So the first time I called you, I said, look, my son, which was Brian, he was playing basketball. He goes, man, I'd really like to go see the Magic play. I go, all right, well, let me call Andy. So I call you up. Sure as crap, man. You get me the best seats in the world. I'm sitting right behind the Magic, literally. And I can remember because I went multiple times, but one time my son was wearing a Philadelphia Phillies hat because he'd been working out with Kurt Schillings, who was one of my clients that I took fishing. And Ken Griffey Jr. walks up to sit down beside us. And my son takes off his Phillies hat and he goes, Mr. Griffey, will you sign this hat for me? And Ken looks at him and goes, you know, I don't normally sign a Phillies hat, but I'll do it for you. So he had Curt Schilling's hat on, who was signed by Curt, and then he had Ken Griffey's signature underneath it. He still has it.
That's cool.
But it was only because you got me the tickets.
Oh, man.
And I think you got them for me three or four times, maybe four or five times.
I was married to somebody in the high place.
Yeah. I remember I called your house one time. And Chrissy answered and she said, who is this? I said, this is Al DePerrick. And she goes, oh, well, he can talk to you.
No, I talk to everybody.
So you must have put the good word in or something.
Well, look, you do everything you can for good friends, and I really appreciate it because nobody knows the home of Sasa fishery, I think, quite as well as you do in the way you've gone about your life chasing these records. But let's go back to the beginning. You know, we all start somewhere. Where was your start with fishing, and how impactful was that?
Well, I started young. You know, should I fish when I was a little kid, like all of us? And then I started fishing in a tournament called the Suncoast Tarpon Tournament, which was really a great tournament. All the locals in this area and all over fished it. We had a great time. It was a lot of fun, very competitive. And I was fishing bait, like most of everybody, and catching some nice fish on bait. Then I switched over to plug tackle and caught some really nice fish on plug. And then I ran into my good friend, Neil Sigvarsson, who owned CNN Auto Parts at the time. And he goes, man, why are you wasting your time with that crap? I'm like, what are you talking about, dude? It's fun. He goes, you need to go fly fishing with me. I'm like, fly fishing? You got to be crazy, dude. So he breaks out this old wedding cake Fenor and an old Equalizer fiberglass fly rod. He goes, this is what we use. I said, really? Then he told me what they cost. I said, you got to be nuts. He goes, no, man, you need to come and go with me. I said, all right, I'll go. So I go up there with him the first time. I didn't know nothing. I'm just with Neil. And he knew his way around. The fish were so thick back then, they basically just rode around till they seen them and shut their motors off. So we were fishing in a boat who was Norman Duncan's original boat called the Xanadu. It was an old wood Willie Roberts. And we poled from the bow. We didn't have a poling platform. Had an old Evinrude on it. We went, the boat, you'd have to start turning 3 days sooner to get to your turn because the boat would slid so bad. So anyhow, the first time I went, he goes, you see all that out there? I'm like, all that stuff sticking up out of the water. I remember it like it was yesterday. It was all fish laid up on the surface in a place called Black Rock. I mean, solid, far as you could see, fins and tails. I go, man, are you kidding me? He goes, no, dude, that's them. So I don't know how many we caught that day. I pulled him around and turned left when I should have turned right, did everything wrong, but he still caught a bunch of fish. So we go back to his house and I start learning how to cast. We took his dog and put it on a leash. And he goes, now when the dog's walking by, aim at the dog. So he taught me how to cast. And then I practiced throwing at his pit bull without a hook. And he took me up there a few times and I couldn't catch one. I could hook him, but man, I'm like, I am never going to get one to the boat. He's like, yeah, you will. Yeah, you will. So I remember it was my 12th fish. And I had talked to Al Pfluger. We talked to Al that morning. He goes, you know, if you gaff them down towards their butt with a kill gaff, this is what he told us, it won't hurt them, but you'll get them. And I'm like, I'm drooling. Literally to get one in the boat because I cannot get one in the boat. So I'm like, Neil, come on, Neil, gaff this sucker for me. So I'd had him on for like 2 hours, you know, total. So I'm like, come on, man, gaff this fish for me. He's like, dude, I don't want to get, he had an old aluminum 8-foot gaff, you know? So he goes, all right, man, I'm going to gaff him for you. I said, all right. So I get him up close to the boat and he sticks this tarpon, right? And this thing's still green, bro, because I got no clue. You know, I'm just learning. He sticks his spoon in the back of the boat and he went from the back of the boat to the front of the boat. And the sad story is we had just non-skidded that boat and we used sawdust back in the day and resin. So it was like equivalent to worse than 80 grit sandpaper. It was like devastating to your skin. He come back, he's bleeding from the elbows, his gaff's bent in half. And he's like, you son of a bitch. I can't believe it. I told you we couldn't gaff that thing. Of course, it got away, broke my tippet, and was gone.
Right.
But I waded through all that, fished for years up there, and then I finally started catching a few and got better at it like we all do. And then I bought my first flats boat from Freddie Archibald. I bought a Shipoke, and I started guiding because I had my license. I was already live bait guiding here at the house, and Freddie said, "Hey, man, I can get you a bunch of clients." And I said, "Well, that's good." So he was staying on a place called Tiger Island. It was really just called Party Island. So I hooked up with Freddie and Mike Suchek, and we stayed there, and we started fishing out of the river. And I fished a lot of people that had no clue, which I wasn't really that good at that time neither, because I just started guiding up there, but I wanted to get my feet wet. So Freddie got me some good clients. I learned a lot, and I fished hard, and people got to recognize me because I was taking people that weren't that good, and I was catching fish. So then I started fishing with a lot of my other friends, and we were fishing for records and wading through all the crap. And then Freddie said, "I got a couple of really good guys I want you to fish with. You know, I fished a guy named Glenn Lau," and then I fished him for a while. And then Suchek came along, and Tom had been fishing with Suchek for a while. Well, Suchek decided he wasn't going to fish anymore. And Suchek said, "But I got a guy for you." Now, this is probably 10 years into it now that I've been guiding up there, probably at least 10 years. And I'd had all kinds of people that couldn't fish. You know,
what year is
this? I waded through it. It would have been I'm not good at dates, but I started fishing up there in the late 70s. So it would have probably been late 80s,
mm-hmm.
probably the late 80s, I'm guessing. Somewhere around there.
Well, I left home.
When did you fish?
In 88. I left in 88.
And you fished one or two days with me, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just a couple.
Yeah.
But I fished with Tommy Locke. I fished with Eddie Walker a little bit. Miller.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Miller.
Yeah.
I wasn't there a whole lot, but I felt like I couldn't get better because the fishing had already kind of fallen off the cliff mm-hmm. a little bit. So mm-hmm. I went to the Keys because mm-hmm. I knew there were more fish down there. But what do you remember about who found the fish in Homosassa?
Well, to my knowledge, is a good friend of mine, Kirk Smith, and another guy named Harold LeMaster. I've talked to him about it. And he used to hang out at the same marina that I run out of a lot. And I got to be good friends with him. And Kirk told me that they basically followed fish from Palm Harbor here in the Gulf all the way to Bayport is where they started fishing with their plug rods. They used to run their little 14-foot Carlsons with their 35s on it. They just kept fishing further up the coast. And when they finally got up there, that's where they ran into the meat, a lot of fish. And I know they were there. And then Norman Duncan and another fisherman named Gary Marconi, who Dan Malzone probably told you about, showed up there. This is to my knowledge. And then Lefty Cray got in there.
And wrote about it.
And then more people came in. And I guess Neil was very good friends with Gary and Danny Malzone. And they were fishing it before I was fishing it. But they turned me on to it, like I told you, with Neil. Right. They helped me out with it. So now that's as far as I know. That's a story I've been told. And I talked to Kurt about it. And Kurt told me the same story.
Right.
So I think that's exactly what happened. And then it just progressed from there mm-hmm. to where it got out of control.
Let's talk about, before we dive fully into Homosassa and all the players and the world records and stuff, let's go back to the fish on the West Coast in general, Boca Grande. You were talking about a little bit ago about fishing offshore Boca with plugs and this permit you have on the wall.
Right. Yeah.
Because that seems like that's Tarpon Central, the pass.
It's the hole. my friend, like I talked about before, Mike, and another friend of mine, Scott Sadorf, is a very good fisherman and a great guy. We used to go down there. We were plug fishing. We were some of the earliest plug casters down there. About the only person we would see would be the cracker casters, the corked fishermen.
Yeah, what's that?
That's where they take four aughts and big conventional reels and learn to spin cast over their head, and they can throw a pinfish 200-300 feet on the money. the old timers were really good at it. Really good. And they caught a lot of fish.
But they would spin, you're saying that they would spin their rod tip?
Yes.
In a circle their rod tip and over, then launch it?
And then sling it. Yeah. And they were very accurate. Very good at it.
And that's what's called cracker
casting.
Cracker casting. Yep. Like cracking a whip type of thing.
And that's where Boca Grande beach fishing really started. Bobby Buswell on the Miss Budweiser ran a boat called the Lily Tiger. And then we showed up with our plugs, which wasn't a real popular item.
Why?
So we're out fishing, and literally, I think you could ask any of my friends, we're jumping 80 to 100 fish a day, trying to figure out how to keep them off. And mixed in with the tarpon were permit everywhere. And so we're catching fish one day, and in the middle of the day, the fish wouldn't show in the morning, but as soon as it slicked off, they popped up everywhere. And we look around, there's a boat running at us. I'm like, I asked Mike, I go, who's this guy? So he runs up to us, and it's Bobby Buswell. He hollers over to us. It's guys like you that are going to ruin this place. There's too many of you now. What the hell are you doing here with that, throwing them plugs? And we're like, we look at each other. We didn't have time to yell back at him. He put it in the nine hole and took off again.
The nine hole.
In the nine hole. But needless to say, he was probably right, because after that, it took off. Everybody started coming down there throwing plugs. And
why were the plugs so effective?
I guess we used to throw a 65M fire glow, which was a pretty fast sinking mirror lure. But honestly, they got so thick, the fish got so thick that you just ride around and find a crab on the surface. We were jumping them on rubber worms. It didn't matter what you threw out there. If you threw it out there to them and one jumped off, another one would grab it.
Before you'd reel it
before
in.
Before you could even get it in the water. I remember Scotty. Scotty left one of my plug rods sitting on the bow of the boat, literally with the plug hanging off the side of the boat. The poon came up, grabbed the plug, and pulled it overboard. Lost the plug rod, which back then, we didn't have a lot of money. Every plug rod we had was serious business. You know, we got a good plug rod. It was good. So, yeah, Scotty left it dangling over the side, and he grabbed it and pulled it overboard.
Did you fish Boca a fair amount?
We fished it for a long time like that, offshore. Offshore. I never fished in the past. That never really appealed to me much.
Right.
But that fishing out there was absolutely epic. The permit I have mounted on my wall, like I told you, was I mounted that memory of that fishery because I knew I'd probably never see it again. I mean, it was every day. It wasn't periodically. It was every day. We would drive down there and try to beat the afternoon thunderstorms out. Just for that fishery. And it's 2.5-3 hours every day for us to drive down there. But
wow.
It was that good.
Was it just the biomass that was hanging out offshore?
What it appeared to have happened is when it had rained a lot in the summertime, that brackish water would go out there and they would get right on the tide line. And literally you could go out there in the morning. I didn't do it, but I know a few people that did. They said you could troll a plug and catch them, but they wouldn't come up. They wouldn't come up till it slicked off in the middle of the day, just ahead of the sea breeze, and then they'd be laid up all over the surface. Thousands, literally hundreds, just as many as you could ever imagine, as far as you could see.
Do you think that biomass moved north up to Homosassa area? Because it seems like that's what you were seeing up there as well.
Well, I know this much for certain, that some of the records we caught and the fish we were releasing were tagged. And they were tagged by a gentleman called Nat Italiano in Boca Grande. And then when we caught the fish in Homosassa, we tracked the tags back, and that's where they had come from. Every fish we caught, including some world records that had a tag in them, were tagged in Boca Grande before we got them. So obviously they were coming back and forth, some
sure,
of them.
Sure.
That was back when Stu invented the tagging stick. Do you remember
that? Oh, did Stu invent that?
Yeah, I don't know if he invented it, but he's the one that you got them all for me, and he was promoting it.
Right.
It was basically a broom handle stick with a dart on the end of it. You stuck the tag in behind their scale by their dorsal fin, and they tracked a lot of tarpon that way.
Did anybody ever catch one of the tagged fish that you released?
Oh, yeah. We caught quite a few in Homosassa. In fact, Clyde caught 100, I think his record was 177 on 12. That fish had a tag in it.
From you?
Boca Grande. Not from me.
But from Boca Grande.
From Nat Italiano.
Yeah, yeah.
He had tagged it in Boca Grande. And then Danny and Clyde caught that fish on 12. and it had a tag in it and it had been tagged by Nat. So there were a lot of big tarpon, and there still is a lot of big tarpon in Boca Grande. And obviously a lot of them were going back and forth.
Right.
And the big difference today is we don't have the food to hold them. And right. they do. And crabs come out of that pass and the shrimp. And
so the food went away, I think, from what we've all heard through the high salinity of the water coming out of the creeks. Is that correct?
I don't know that.
That's what they speculate.
I don't know that. All I know for certain is when we were first fishing up there for a first maybe 10 years, crabs everywhere. You could pull one crab trap. And Danny used to make this spaghetti sauce for us when we were all staying at Pine Island at his still house. And he'd pull one crab trap and it had 15 blue crabs in it. That'd be all he'd need. And I know that the people used to rent inner tubes and float down the Chaz River and the Weekiwachee River and dip crabs, and they'd make one pass and have a cooler full. Now today, there are no blue crabs.
Yeah.
There's no food. Mm-hmm. So I don't know about salinity. I don't know about all that stuff, but I do know if there's no food,
no fish,
we're going to go find something to eat somewhere.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Do you remember the first day you went out there in Homosassa?
Yeah, I was with Neil. I didn't know Jack Squat.
How many
I just
fish,
went looking.
How many fish did you see? What was it like?
Oh, God. Thousands laid up on top at one time. Thousands. Literally. And the more I got into it, I can remember in my mind right now looking on that white sand. It was John Emery, myself, down at Pine Island. And as far as you could see, literally, as far as you could see, was nothing but tarpon and 4 to 6 foot of water on white sand, as far as you could see. Now, not side by side, but
sure.
just
Every 10, spread out.
10 fish strings, 15 fish strings. Unbelievable.
And that's when the Poon House with your shirt,
yeah.
is that
yeah.
when it was established? You said, yeah. I'm going to be here. So you just started renting and staying there the whole season?
God, we rented everything we could find. Houses, condos. I lost my job. Well, I didn't lose my job, but I decided to retire early. It ruined me.
What job did you have at the time?
I was a firefighter. I retired after 15 years, but the more I tarpon fished and the busier I got, I'd pay people to work for me. I couldn't stay away from it. It was a bad addiction. I mean, it's crazy how hooked you get mm-hmm. when the fishing's that good. I mean, it's you don't eat lunch. Time just flies by.
Right.
It's incredible. Adrenaline, as much fun as you can have.
Was it hard sleeping at night?
Oh, yeah, man. You couldn't wait to get up and go again. We'd be there before the sun came up. Crazy.
Who were
I remember one morning I was fishing with Neil's buddy and my shy poke. It was in my earlier years, and I just got a brand new Mark IV Seamaster. And you know how hard they are to get.
Sure.
They were hard.
They didn't make many of the fours.
So I had been pulling Peter around, who's a great fisherman up there, one of Neil's best friends and one of my great friends. He caught two or three and he goes, all right, it's your turn. Well, my hands were soaking wet, man. You know, I'd been pulling. And so I jump down on the bow. I make one cast. Poon eats it. I get tied on him and my hands are wet. And shit, the rod slips right out of my hand. The brand new Mark IV, man. It's skipping across the deck of the bow of my boat. So I lunge over there and I grab it and I got it back. But man, I can remember that like it was yesterday because that was crazy, dude.
I think it was somebody they lost a Seamaster up there on a fish and somebody else found it. Somebody else found it.
That was a story in itself.
Like years later.
That was, God. What was his name?
I have no idea.
Oh, I know.
I just remember the story.
Having a senior moment.
Rufus or somebody?
No, it wasn't Rufus. Rufus didn't lose. But anyhow, Tom and I were sitting in Becky's. That's where we all used to meet
for
breakfast.
Sure, I remember.
You know? So Tom and I are sitting and they're eating. Brett Fowler was the guy's name. Fowler. We used to call him, his name was Fowler. We called him Birdman. So
why'd you call him Birdman? How'd you get that nickname?
Just a nickname.
You came up with all the nicknames for everybody.
Goofy as the day is long. Guy was out there. So we're sitting there eating breakfast. Tom and I were looking at each other. We heard Birdman talk and he's like, you know what? I've been watching some videos and learning some new stuff. He goes, I'm going to do the down and dirty. you know, the down and dirty.
When you're fighting fish.
Yeah, trying to turn him upside down. Tom and I are looking at each other. Boy, oh boy, the down and dirty, you know. So he looks at me and I kind of look at him. We're kind of going like, you're like, yeah, right. So it was like blowing northeast, cold. Nobody wanted to go. So Tom and I are going, let's go, Tom. So Tom was always ready to go.
Right.
Tom will go like right now. So we go out there. We're by ourselves. And these fish are pouring down Pine Island. Well, Danny had a telescope set up on his deck at his house on Pine Island, his still house. So he calls me on the radio because we didn't have phones then. He calls me on the radio and he goes, what are all them splashes I'm seeing around your boat? I said, bro, the poon's out here. You need to come on and go. So he comes out. He's fishing. He's up to the north of us a little bit. And he's with Fowler, the down and dirty guy, right? He calls me up. He goes, Al, keep your eyes open for a fly line. I'm going, what? He goes, yeah, man. He goes, Fowler was doing the down and dirty and the poon pulled his rod and reel out of his hand and he's towing it off. A Mark IV Seamaster. So Fowler was doing the down and dirty. The poon didn't like it. Pulled the rod and reel out of his hand. He said, see if you can see it come by. He was going your way. The rod and reel was supposedly, he put a bounty out on it, found like a year later by a guy named Bob Parliman, said that a trout fisherman snagged the line up by Chaz River, which would be about 7 miles from where the fish was hooked. So I think the story is a little different, but that was the rumor that a trout fisherman hooked it and gave it to Parliman, and Parliman got the bounty. In reality, I think Parliament put his snorkel gear on and went snorkeling to Pine Island and found it and got the bounty because I think he gave him $1,500. Back then, $1,500 is pretty good money.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was a story in itself.
Mm-hmm.
The down and dirty.
When did you guys start record fishing?
First day Tom jumped on my boat. I had developed a boat called the Silver King now.
Right.
Which
with Klingel? With the Klingels?
No, I started without the Klingels. I actually started that boat. I borrowed a haul from another charter boat captain in the area who's a very good fisherman, Dave Marquette. He loaned me a 17-foot Mako, and I took it up to Tarpon with another friend of mine, and we turned it upside down. We put some running strikes in it and built the Silver King, which was a prototype.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I took it down to the Keys and I fished with Steve Huff. I said, tell me what you think about this boat. Cause I got to know him pretty good at Home Assassin. We talked and stuff. So I went down there. He goes, well, I'll pull you around. Let's go bone fishing. I said, all right. So he's pulling me around. I can't catch my ass. I mean, I can catch, cause man, you're a good caster, but I had never caught a bonefish on fly yet. You know, I was pretty green at it.
Right.
So I go, all right, it's your turn. Well, of course, you know what happens. I pull him two strokes. He makes one cast and catches about a 10-pounder. He goes, dude, you just got to know how to strip. So long story short, he goes, man, I like this boat. He goes, it floats shallower. I think then he was running the old Dolphin skiff.
Right.
With a lot of V in the bottom. Great riding boat.
But absolutely. They didn't,
yeah. So he was running that boat that he had made. And he said, man, I really like this boat. Well, shortly after that, we built three or four prototypes, maybe a few more than that. And I didn't want to build anymore. So I built one for myself and I'd fished it. And that's the boat Tom and I first started fishing in. But long story short, Mike Suchek and Mr. Klingel bought the molds. And then they retooled them and made them what they are today, of course, you know, with a diamond non-skid.
Sure. Yeah.
We put carpet in the cockpit. And, you know, they were just fishing machines.
Right.
But that was the boat that I first started fishing Tom in. Yeah. So we were record fishing day one. The first day I fished him, to get back to what you asked me, I picked him up and I'd had the fish dialed in. Back in the day, you could dial them in. You knew where they were going to be on a certain tide at a certain place and where they were going to come through. It was that easy. It wasn't tough.
Right.
So I picked him up. I didn't know him from spit. You know, all I knew is I always thought to myself, if I could get this guy on my boat, I'm going to catch a lot of tarpon because I'd been fishing people. I'd earned my way up. Mm-hmm. I didn't start out at fishing Tom Evans off the get-go.
Right.
I started off fishing a lot of beginners.
But the actual quote from the first podcast we all did, mm-hmm. you said, if I can get that big bastard on my boat, we fuck him up.
Yeah. Well, I did say that. Yeah. I was thinking that.
Yeah.
But so anyhow, yeah, like I said, in the original, we went to the spot I shut down. I said, you see that big black spot? And he goes, yeah. I said, well, that's all fish. He goes, it is? I said, yeah. So I pulled over there and we ended up catching boating seven that day. We boated seven. Tom went to the airport. I guess he told Tanya, from what he's told me, is he said, I found somebody that we're going to catch a lot of fish. So he said he went, had stomach cramps and bleeding from his stomach from the rod butt. And it was good for me because I finally got somebody on the boat that was really just a great fisherman, you know.
Well,
and I only could fish so many days because I had other clients.
Right.
So I had to kind of wing him in to get me more days. And
you're so loyal, you're not going to fire anybody.
No, I don't believe in it.
Yeah.
No. Well, Tom and I, absolutely best friends.
Yeah,
for the whole time we fished.
I think a real testament to your loyalty is now Tom is 80 some years old.
Yeah.
His mobility is shot.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like you.
Maybe just a little worse. Yeah.
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 Very, yeah.
Very yeah. close. But over the last number of years, you figured out how to reconfine your boat to get him comfortable so you can go out. And you're still pushing him a full month.
He's fishing eight. He's
eight
fishing eight, and he's had fish on
year.
Every year. He's been catching a few fish, but the fishing's nowhere close to what it used to be.
Yeah, no,
you
I
know.
Get that.
So we have a great time. We still catch some fish. If the weather's really bad, we don't stay as long.
Right,
but there's no reason to anyhow.
Yeah, no,
there's no reason to.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah. Let's go back before we jump into the records with Tom and the records that you guys amassed, which are legendary, and they'll remain in that record book forever. Let's go back to when it was on fire. You had Billy Pate, Stu Apt, Tom.
Everybody.
Pfluger.
Yeah.
And all the great guides. Yeah. Huff was out there.
Yeah.
What was the Poon House like out there when you had all, it's like Mount Rushmore of tarpon fishing.
Yeah.
And every day you were chasing a record, and almost weekly, the records and the barrier of the big fish was rocketing skyward.
Yeah, getting tougher.
What was that like out there when it was on fire with all these great legendary fishermen and guides?
Competitive. Very competitive. I mean, for me it was, because I wanted to be the best. I didn't want anybody to catch as many as me. I didn't want anybody to even jump as many as me. I wanted to be the best at what I was doing, which pretty much is where I've been with everything.
Where did that come from? Just from a young man, you always?
Yeah, just competitive. I played a lot of sports and can't take losing. And if somebody did better than me and I went to bed at night, it'd drive me crazy. I'm like, how the hell did I miss those fish? Or, you know, why didn't I think to go over there, you know, or something? I would always think back about, why didn't I, you know, how did I miss that?
And you're with the right guy, because Tom's the same way.
Oh, Yeah. We went hard. I mean, shit, if the weather was bad and it broke at noon, we'd go out at noon. We'd go out at 1 o'clock, fish till the afternoon. And we caught fish every day. I mean, religiously. But it was a lot of fun. I remember talking to Stu a lot, and I really admired him because he was such a great fisherman. And he still is, I guess. You know, I haven't talked to him in a long time. But the guy could do anything. You know, with plugs, it didn't matter. He's just a really, really, really very good fisherman.
Was there anybody in particular that you guys learned from, or were you guys setting the bar yourselves?
Well, if I was to say I learned anything from anybody, it'd be Huff. You know, I watched him pretty close because I knew he was the elite. He was the best when I was coming up, even, you know.
In Home Assassin. He was already the best
guy. Oh, he was really good. And I watched him pretty close, what he did, where he kind of went. I would never follow him or get close, but I studied how he worked his boat, how he worked the tide a little bit, you know, because he had it dialed in. I mean, that's Steve Huff, you know.
So how often were your eyes on him versus the fish?
Well,
kind of both. You'd always see where he was.
Early on, I watched him quite a bit. You know, because I had still had a lot to learn. When I had my shy poke, he was up there. I think he was running a shy poke also that he built himself. And I didn't really know him then, but I knew he was good at what he did. And I watched him on and off, you know, for a couple of years. I never got too super close, but I could figure out what was going on. And it took me a while to learn to play. We got rocks that we fish. We got ledges that we fish. We got a place called Kidney Rock. We got the Dilly Hole. We got the Guido Rock. I mean, we got the Middle Rack.
Eiger.
We got Eigers, which is awesome.
The Cock Hole.
The Cock Hole. It goes on and on and on, you know. So, and there were certain places the fish track. There's little trenches and stuff that you had to learn.
Was it
even back in the day? Even back in the day, there would be periods of time when it'd go slack, and you'd have to wait for the tide to change and the fish to move. But the guys that really knew what they were doing, that were in the fish deep, they knew to get to Pine Island in the afternoon on the outgoing tide.
I remember that.
And that's all you had to do. And here they come. I mean, just string after string of these giant tadpoles.
I remember looking to the beach and the sun setting behind you.
Yeah.
And they'd be in the waves.
Oh,
these
beautiful.
Big 8-foot long tadpoles.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I fished Chris Parkening for a long time, a lot of years. He was a fabulous fisherman. We caught a lot of fish together.
Duck Camp makes outdoor goods so you can outdoor good. From the shallow water flats to the mallard-filled marshes, Duck Camp is there to make you feel comfortable and enhance the quality of your time in the elements. Not only do they make some of the best outdoor apparel on the market, but they support many of the organizations near and dear, fighting for a resource in the natural world. Check them out at duckcamp.com and tell them we sent you. Starting from a 90-year-old family recipe, Wickles are wickedly delicious pickles packed with garlic and peppers, a staple in our skiff and all shoreline lunches. Originating from Sim's grandmother's kitchen to a pantry near yours, from pickles, okra, relishes, and spreads, check them out to elevate all of your meals to the next level.
I remember he showed up one year, and we'd had horrible weather. I mean, the pits, bad as it gets, no fish for like 4 or 5 days. Well, Chris showed up, and I had Clyde for one more day, and I gave Chris to a guy named Phil Chapman. He's a kind of legendary, been around a long time. And he fished with Chris and a couple of Chris's friends that came. We gave to somebody else. I don't remember who. And fishing had been brutal. And Chris was very competitive. As you know, I think he still holds a record in the Gold Cup when it was a kill tournament for the most points ever acquired when he fished with Harry.
Yeah, maybe. Because he did win.
Very,
he
very
did
good.
Win the Gold Cup with
Extremely
Harry.
Extremely good fisherman.
Great caster.
Oh, yeah. My gosh. It was fun to watch him. So anyhow, he shows up, and I'm like, Chris, man, fishing's been brutal, dude. I said, if you want to go catch some redfish or something, we'll go do that. He said, Al, I'd rather cast it one tarpon than catch 100 redfish. I said, okay, we'll go look. So we go out in the morning. It's pretty much dead. I look out towards a place we used to call the Lean and Steak at Pine Island. I seen a bust. I went, wow, that looked like a poon bust. So Clyde was with me. We pulled out there, and from that day, for the next 10 days, we were covered up asshole deep. It didn't matter where you went. It didn't matter how deep you were. Everywhere around the boat, there was poons. Chris and I, and this is the gospel truth, we jumped 37 in one day, and I was jumping them off of the casting platform, the back of the polling platform, just for something to do.
Right.
We tried every fly we had in the box, and it didn't matter. Topwater chuggers, it didn't matter.
Right.
They were eating everything.
But I remember when I was over there, to get a bite, all you had to do is put the fly in the right
That's
spot.
That's all you had to do.
Was there a time when that changed and all of a sudden you had to feed the fish?
Oh, yeah.
Be really technical, smaller flies and bump and feed them?
My famous quote got to be, if he knows how it got there, he's not going to eat it.
You
got to make
sure.
The presentation where he has no idea where it came from. If he sees your butt section or any part of your tippet, we call it wrong eye, you're done. Forget it. Pick it up. He ain't going to eat it. That's the way it is today, pretty much.
How did that switch? Is the pressure of the...
It's had to be. It's a,
had
it's,
to have been pressure.
Had to have been pressure.
Had to I
been
remember.
Pressure. I don't see what else it could have been.
Yeah.
Well, there's not the numbers of fish, which is a big factor.
So there's less fish and more
there's
people.
There's less fish, more people.
Yeah.
And it's not only at Homosassa. Yeah, it's up and down the whole coast. It's in the Keys. Yeah, it's in Boca Grande. Those guys, even on bait.
Maybe Apalachicola, you know, in that dirty water, they're going to bite, you know, easily. I remember.
Are better. But even that place, compared to the guys that I talked to, like Steve Kilpatrick's, he fished that place long before I heard about any of these other guys that were fishing it. He fished it probably 25, 30 years ago. Steve did, I think.
Right.
It's been a long time.
Yep.
And when he went up there with Shaw Grigsby, it was game on no matter what you threw or what you did, kind of like Home Assassin was. But my understanding now is it's even gotten tougher.
Right.
More people, less room, same gig.
I remember I was interviewing Billy Pate for my book.
Yeah.
And that was right when he was starting to get dementia.
Mm-hmm.
It was coming on pretty aggressively. And maybe he left Home Assassin before this transition took place. But I asked Billy, I asked him the same question. I said, do you remember when it changed from just presenting the fly correctly to having to feed the fish and be really, really smart and sophisticated with the feeding of the fish? He looked at me like I was talking about who was the first guy who landed on Mars.
Oh, I'm sure.
He had no idea, but I could have been his memory too.
No, probably wasn't, because when I started, it didn't matter. You throw it over their back, throw it at them going away. It didn't matter. But I promise you, them records that Tom and I caught together, it had to be right.
Yeah.
Even starting then, it had to be right. We had to handpick some of them fish that we caught. I mean, we seen them, we fished to them, and that's all Tom ever wanted to do anyhow. He had no desire to go out in the cock hole and dredge one up. That's not Tom. He don't want no part of that.
Yeah.
He wants to see him come down that white sand, pick out a face that he can throw it to, and watch him eat it.
Was there a lot of, not animosity, but was there a lot of butting the minds and the heads out there between Billy Pate, who had the 188 on 16, and Tom, because I remember Tom used to call him William Pate. Was there a lot of dislike among the anglers or possibly guides too?
I don't know that it was a huge dislike. I think it was a lot of just competitive fun and
egos
a little bit. I think there was a few moments where they might have had words. People might have had a few words. You know, I had words with guides that ticked me off, you know, if they ran me over and did something that I wouldn't do to somebody.
Right.
You know, I'm like, you know, we all had words occasionally,
right,
especially with that many people. But even today, we don't have any issues up there. Mm-hmm. We're all get along. We all know the rules. If we get a newcomer, they're more than welcome, but you play by the rules. And as long as if you make a mistake, you apologize for it, and then you don't do it again, you don't have no problems.
Is it pretty obvious because there's so many boats and there's not an edge per se, but there are paths that they travel.
Oh, absolutely.
But how about, say, somebody who doesn't know that intricacy, can they accidentally catch your fish off, or is it pretty obvious?
Well, it depends on the time of year. If it's slick calm and they're rolling and blooping, yeah, they can catch some. You know, they come and go up and down different areas. But today it's changed so much from what it used to be. I mean, we had tracks. I remember I was fishing Danny when Danny Malzone owned Dan Sports. So I was in shore a huff, and he was fishing. I can't remember the gentleman's name. He was a stockbroker guy that lived on fish with him. I think his name, first name was Tom, maybe. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, Danny and I were just, I was on the line and I didn't have to move. And I mean, we were jumping a fish, just, it was stupid. One after another, just crazy. I mean, literally choo-choo trains coming down the flat. You look up, here come a big old wake and have 100 or 200 in it. And behind them, another 100 or 200. And we were flying them left and right. So Huff pulled over to me and Danny goes, man, you guys are putting on a show. Because he was just a hair outside of me and he wasn't in them. But when it slowed down, he came over and said, my goodness, you guys put on a show. And we did. We were hammering them.
But
it was all about a track.
Right.
You know,
could you get behind that guy? And would that guy in front put the fish down and the guy behind him was not going to get bites?
Yeah. That was one of the things that caused a few issues up there, is if a guy was ahead of you and he was on the line, you didn't want to cut in front of him. You know, if you want to get behind him, it was fine. But you never got in front of somebody and cut them off if they were at the top of the end, you know?
Tell me about Bobby Era.
He was a good fisherman. I think we all know some of his activities, but
was he a part of the inner group?
To a point, but he didn't mess with me because he wanted my approval, because he knew that I played fair. You know, I didn't do things to other people that I wouldn't want them to do to me.
Right.
I tried to be courteous, and if I made a mistake, which I had, I'd go to somebody and apologize. Hey, man, sorry, I got too close to you. I didn't see you, and I cut in front of you. My bad, you know, which was good, because if you do that, it's behind you. Go on to the next day, you know.
All you can do is say, I'm sorry.
That's it.
And
it
really didn't mean it.
And that's all you can do.
Right.
And if you're good enough to do that, you learn from it and move on. Well, Bobby knew that I wouldn't want to say I was the ringleader, but if I didn't like you and I didn't like what was going on, people respected that because of the way I was.
Right.
So
would they go to you if somebody was making a mistake and say, hey, Al, what do I do?
Always. To this day.
So you're the voice.
I have somewhat. Yeah. People respect me just because of the way I treat people.
Right.
You know, and they see what I do and how I handle myself. So I hope that they learn, you know, that, hey, you know, you don't have to fish that way. Be respectful, blah, blah, you know, the whole situation.
Yeah.
I've had people fish all around me, literally covered up, and have a guy pull up to me in a jet ski. You know, well, he don't know any better.
Right.
He has no idea. So you simply tell him, look, this is what we're doing. This is what we're trying to do. And when you leave here, it'd be best if you go the other direction. Don't run through that pack of boats.
Right.
And 90% of the time, most people will understand that.
Right.
You don't have to scream and cuss and shout and threaten people.
Yeah.
Unless they do it two or three times. Then it becomes another issue.
Who were your tight group of guys? Malzone?
Danny was really, really, really one of the guys I talked to all the time. Steve Kilpatrick's. Of course, Neil, when he was there,
right.
Neil wasn't able to go all the time back in the day.
Would you guys talk every night after fishing?
Oh, yeah. Shoot, we'd all camp out at Danny's Stilt House. That was crazy times. A little bit out of control. Really bad.
That was the poon house.
That was one of the poon houses. Yeah, that was the main poon house back in the day. That was Neil and Pete and myself and Danny and another guy named Jack. We're all staying in one Stilt House.
That must have been crazy.
Nice place right on the beach at Pine Island.
And I love the fact that Danny had an IGFA scale, so any record came to shore,
it was perfect.
I loved how when you had a big fish going in for a record, Tom Wade said, we're going to take it for a boat ride.
Yeah. God.
Let's talk a little bit about record fishing and how all of a sudden that whole chase started. And how you got really connected with the records with Tom.
Well, like I said earlier, you know, we started fishing together, and from day one, that's what he wanted to do.
Right.
I hadn't been really that much tuned into just catching record fish, although I had been trying to catch one back in the day. It was on 10.
Right.
I think Lenny Berg had the record, the guy that originally owned Maverick.
Right.
He had a 10-pound record, and I was trying to bust that 10-pound record. And I'd been really close with my friend Scott Sayedorf. We were fishing together, buddy fishing. I never did catch one big enough. I did catch some, but not one big enough. So I had been chasing them a little bit myself.
Mm-hmm.
But when I got Tom on the boat, and I knew I had somebody on the boat that was capable of catching them, we just went wide open for them.
Right.
So.
But it seems like everybody's mission every day was to catch a record.
Oh, absolutely. That's what the whole place was about. Yeah. And you know, it started out with that 12, and then it went to, 15, 16. And then we got that 20 introduced. But yeah, nobody fished much less. Well, like I said, Bird had a 10-pound record when it was 10-pound. And that was about as light. And I don't think that fish was caught somewhere else. I don't think it was caught in Assassin.
Would you not throw to a fish that was not a record?
No. No, we would. Yeah, we, Tom.
Because that's a lot about the growing, the growing curve of getting better.
Oh, that's the only way to get better. Mm-hmm. That's the problem today. That's why a lot of guys can cast, but they're clueless when it comes to getting a fish on the line.
The would the dynamics of how Tom fought fish and how you guided, did it change when you knew you had a record on the end of your string?
Maybe a little more focused, you know. We would get more dialed in. I would have to, because I had to keep the boat in the right position in the right place, because you get a record fish on, you don't just sit down and run the motor. I mean, you got to keep the fly line in the right place. You got to keep the right angles.
Right.
You know, you got to keep him in the belly of the fly line. You can't be back there 100 feet thinking you're going to catch a poon.
No, you got to get
right on him. You got to get right on him. A lot of people don't know that. And it's all about angles.
Sure. Well, I've always learned that, you know, my own personal experience, you can't pull until you get the fat part of the fly line
in
your hands.
Exactly right.
And there's where when you pull, that head moves.
Yep.
How hard was it from going, because at that point you might have been running the boat, moving the boat, keeping in position, because you're not pulling, chasing that fish down.
No.
How hard was it going from running the boat to grabbing the gaff to gaffing the fish? That must have been almost impossible, because that takes time.
Yeah, it takes time. With Tom, to be honest, it wasn't as near as bad as with I was fishing with Clyde or fishing a lighter tippet with somebody else. But with Tom, when he got into the boat, he was pretty much done. I never got pulled out of the boat by a fish that I gaffed for Tom. Because when Tom brought them to the boat, they were pretty much shot out. Both of the two big records on 12 and 16, I gaffed them, but they didn't pull me. They were pretty much done.
So here you say the records on 12 and 16. So that 12-pound world record fish is 194.
Mm-hmm.
The 16 is 191, which broke Billy Pate's record.
Right.
I can't imagine that on 12-pound test, and Tom caught that 194 pretty quickly. I can't imagine that fish was done.
It was pretty done to a point where it was easy for me to kill gaff it.
But you know,
and I've been on the other end of the stick too many times.
And we'll talk about that here in a second. Yeah. But what was interesting, Tom called me. He said the record, the tippet of the 12-pound is at the IGFA.
Right.
And I said, okay, because they had the 12-pound tippet that you guys caught, which was 180-pound fish. And Clyde had, I think, a 177,
yes,
178.
Yes,
so
yes.
Now you have that 12-pound record that was beating Clyde's, a 180-pound fish, which is what it turned out to being.
Mm-hmm.
But it overtested.
Overtested, correct.
So when Tom caught the 194 on 12, he called me. I said, Tom, I'll go down and I'll videotape the whole testing.
Good.
So I went down and I videotaped it. And at the IGFA, you have a machine that squeezes the tippet and it breaks it in five different places. So your tippet, your world-class tippet is at least 15 inches, could be a little bit longer.
Right.
So they broke it five times, and there was one break. It broke at 8.9 pounds.
Wow.
Which is very interesting, because at the end, had he pulled 9.5 or 10, it would
have
broken.
Over with. Yeah.
And once it broke it at 8-something, I think it was Jason Schrattweiser that was breaking it at the time. He said, that's going to be a record, because they take the average of the five breaks.
Yeah.
Which I found just fascinating.
That's crazy. I didn't know that. I've never been there.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. That's how they do it.
Huh.
And it's an electronic readout. So you see, you know, the digital readout. So it's incredibly accurate.
I think I stuck that fish down somewhere underneath. I got a good shot at him and stuck him underneath, and he bled out in the boat. And I promise you, there had to be an inch of blood in the bottom of my boat. It was unbelievable how much blood came out of that fish.
How much weight there is, too.
Oh, it's crazy.
And I know you guys, from what I hear, used tampons to put in the hole.
I don't.
Of the
gaff. I didn't
you
do
never
that.
Did.
Nah, I never did that.
Yeah, I think maybe
I just wrap them in a towel and keep them good and wet. That's the key. You got to just soak them.
Yeah. And I remember Lefty saying that a fish that's got big scales dehydrates quicker than
up to 10% of their weight in a short period of time.
Yeah.
Yeah, they dry out.
How aggravating was that when that 180 overtested?
It was pretty bad, because a guy at IGFA told Tom, just go catch another one.
Yeah.
That's not the easiest thing in the world to do. I mean, we'd been after that fish a long time. A long time. Well, it took us 20 years to re-catch that 16-pound fish to the day. 20 years.
Yeah, because Billy Pate had that 188 in place for like 25 years.
Yeah.
Do you chase it for 15 years?
Yeah.
What about Brian Tang? I mean, you guys have been chasing the 8-pound
for
a long time.
Yeah, he is very dedicated to fishing 8. And we caught a 147 that I kill gaffed after about 2.5 hours. And he'd caught a 120 and change with me that wasn't big enough because Steve's got the record at 126, 127.
On 8, it's 127 and a half. Yeah.
So, yeah, we caught a 140, I think it was a 147 that I to this day, we thought it was a done deal.
Did you weigh that on Clyde's scale?
No, Brian has his own scale.
Okay.
Yeah, he has his own scale.
Your son, Brian.
No, Brian Tang.
Oh, Brian.
He keeps his own scale, just like Tom does.
Right.
And they're pre-tested and up to date.
Right.
So, yeah, we weighed the fish, did everything right, got the witnesses, did everything we were supposed to do. And we thought it was a done deal because he'd been sending, Brian is the most anal rigger and about his gear you've ever met. Every night he comes in, cleans his fly line, cleans his rods, checks his reels, spends hours tying his tippets to the tee. And he's one of the best I've ever seen. So anyhow, he sends all his tippet material out to IGFA, pays them religiously to have everything pre-tested. And it was Mason, and we all know that Mason is a little irregular
right.
sometimes.
But also,
so that's all we can figure out. It could have happened.
Well, also, too, when you test a spool, they only probably test the first 15 feet, right? You can't test a full 25 yards or however long that spool is. So maybe in a midsection somewhere, he caught that fish with a piece that might have just been a little, and you didn't miss by much.
No, it was next to nothing.
Like,
9.1 or something.
Yeah.
It was really, really close, but
he was
heartbroken.
Who came up with the name Hootang?
Me.
Yeah, of course he did.
Yeah. He's been with me for, God, I guess 25 years or something.
Yeah.
Now his wife's trying to catch a record.
Yeah. So what's it like gaffing a green fish?
Oh, boy, not fun. Not fun. So the one I can remember the best is it was late May, and I was fishing Clyde Bulge. And a big-time thunderstorm was coming. I mean, as black gets. And the fish were coming good out of Pine Island. Tom was there. He was fishing with Suchek at the time. And Tom and I, when 20-pound first came in, we were actually fishing 16, but we said, you know what? Let's go ahead and weigh a couple of these bigger fish in on 20 to stop the bleeding, because we were afraid guys would start weighing in 120s and 130s and 140s.
But initially, he was really against the 20.
And I think he hates 20. He's never fished 20 to this day.
Right, because I think, wasn't that inspired by Billy Pate?
Yes.
And also, too, I think Pate wanted bill fishing to have like a 3-foot bite tippet.
Yes.
So I think that might be the reason.
And maybe a flying gaff to go along with it.
Exactly right. So I think that's why maybe Tom started calling Billy William Pate.
Yeah. It was just degrading the sport a little bit, we felt like.
Right.
You know, it was 20-pound, 20-pound's 20-pound. But anyhow, so we had weighed a couple fish, and I think Tom had caught one like a 176, I want to say, on 20. Well, Clyde's fishing with me now, and storm's coming. We hook this fish, and we go offshore with it. Now it's blowing. It's already up to about 20, and it's black, and it's coming. So Clyde's like, Al, I really want to kill this fish. I said, Clyde, I really don't think he's big enough. And he goes, well, maybe Tom's stuff won't work, because we just killed a 176. So I'm like, I don't know, man. I don't know. It's not big enough. And I kept telling him, I don't think it is. And Clyde kept saying, well, I think he is. I said, all right, well, I'll gaff him for you. So lo and behold, this fish is still pretty green. Well, he comes up beside the boat, and I gaff him, and I promise you, if you would have hooked me to a pickup truck, it would have been no difference. I can remember to this day, I went underwater, and this 8-foot gaff I'm hanging on to, and I open my eyes, and I can see his tail right in front of my face, and I hear this whoosh, 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 and the whole time I'm getting drugged, and I'm still getting drugged. So I come up, I get enough to get a breath of air. I get a breath of air, and boom, I'm down again like a cork. Off I go again. Now I'm probably realistically 75 yards from the boat. He's pulled me that far. Well, that day I happened to be wearing a red scarf because we didn't have the thinner mask, you know,
right.
that we wore much. We wore scarves. And that damn scarf, every time I tried to come up and get a breath of air, it'd go right in my mouth. And I had a pair of tennis shoes on. So I'm fighting the tennis shoes and the scarf and 20 knot winds, white capping, dude. So I'm like, oh, shit. So I come up to get a breath of air and Clyde yells at me, the hook came out. So now if I stay attached to the poon, it still could be a record.
Right.
But if he gets off, it's over.
Right.
So I'm like, shit. So I chinny my way up the gaff and I take my arm and I stick it up through his gills and out his mouth. So now it's over my head. I'm in 20 knot seas. I got the poon on one arm, the gaff in the other arm, and Clyde has no idea how to run my boat. And it's over my head. And I'm fighting for my life to stay afloat. Well, I look up and there's Mike Suchek and Tom. Like, thank God. So they pick me up. They pick me up. We put the poon in the boat. It was too small. Tom looked at me, goes, Al, I don't think you're going to like the weight of this one. I think it was like 167 or something. I mean, it was a pretty nice fish.
Yeah, but not worth it.
So the next day it had been raining and we're sitting at the Bayport ramp, myself, Mike Suchek, Shaw Grigsby, Steve Kilpatrick's. We're just having a little powwow, you know, at the bench there because it's raining. It's shitty out. We're sitting there shooting the bull. And Shaw looks over at me, goes, what in the hell did you do to your arm? So I told him the story, you know, I said, I stuck my arm up through and I was raw, literally no skin from my armpit to my wrist was just raw meat from his mouth and his gills. Shaw looked at me, he goes, dude, you are crazy. But that's the longest ride I'd ever been on. And I mean, I got pulled forever. How I didn't drown. If Mike and Tom hadn't come out there and picked me up, I don't know what would have happened. It's crazy.
Did you ever think about letting go?
No.
At everyone?
That ain't in my blood.
Yeah.
I never let go.
Yeah.
And I've been pulled over. You know, I've been pulled over probably a half a dozen times fishing eight. And I've been pulled, you know, 20 or 30 yards. But that's nothing, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
But this one, this was the real deal.
He went
in that storm. That was a ride.
It was the ride. Perfect storm.
I can see his tail at this moment. In my face.
Didn't you get yanked out three times with one fish?
Yeah.
That's insane.
And I'll tell you what, one thing for certain is after you hit them, they don't like it. They don't like you anymore. They don't want
the
no
first
part
time
of it.
Or the third time.
Oh, I was with Brian Tang on eight. We got pulled up a creek and the boat bottomed out. It got so shallow. Well, the poon was up in this basin and he was plenty big enough on eight. So he was kind of in this back little cove in this basin. I went, shit, I'm going to get out and get him. So I wade out there and I'm running around. Pooner said he can remember it like it was yesterday. I'm running around with this gaff chasing this poon in this puddle. He ended up getting away. I think I broke him off swatting at him. But, God.
But didn't you get pulled out of the boat three times on one fish?
Yeah, that was on eight. Yeah.
Tell me about that story.
We got pulled up the Chaz River. They always go up the rivers, man. Bad. Well, I figured out a way to make them go east. Originally,
you want them in shallow water.
Yeah. Originally, they kept going offshore on us. Everything wants to go west, you know, go to that deep water. So I figured out a little way to do it to make them turn. And
What was that technique?
Well, you know, a fish is always going to swim in the direction of least resistance,
right.
like you and I would do. Mm-hmm. We'd rather walk downhill than uphill, right? So I figured out over a period of time, these fish are running into the wind. Just don't let them run into the wind. Basically, what you do is if they're running in the wind, you want them to turn. You just let him run out there. Let him run, let him run, let him run, let him run. And you know how they'll get out there so far and they'll start to turn. Well, once he turns and he starts to make that little movement to the right or to the left, once he goes that way, take the pressure off of him. And then he'll go ahead and turn. And then if you keep the pressure off of him, he's going to swim in the direction of the least resistance. So now he's headed east and there's no pressure on him. So you let him swim all the way back into the hill or close to shallow water where you can handle him. Because you're not going to catch him in deep water on eight. It ain't going to happen.
Right.
You're not going to get a shot at him. So I figured that out over a period of time. I watched the fish a couple times when we were fighting him. I'm like, you know what? He's getting out there so far off of the fly line. Good ways out, and he gets out there and he turns. Well, why is he turning? Because the further they get out, the more the drag pressure increases, the more pressure they feel, and they're trying to get away from that pressure. So when they turn and they go downwind, or the easy way, just get on them and let them go. Mm-hmm. Until you get them to where you can handle them. So that took me a long time to figure that one out. But yeah, I gaffed one fish. It pulled out. I didn't get pulled overboard the first time. Second time I got pulled overboard, but I didn't go far and the gaff pulled out. Then I hit him again. We caught him. He was 121 on 8.
Close.
I got him the third time. 121 close. He weighed. Yeah. We weighed him at mm-hmm. Malzone's house on a certified scale. That was with Brian also. He's caught some great fish.
Yeah.
You know, Brian is like the inventor, though. We call him the mad scientist because every year he comes back with something different. A new rod, he owns every reel that's ever been built, I'm sure. And he'll come back every year with something he comes up with.
Anything stuck?
He caught a 147 on 8, and the next year he came back with a new rig. I'm like, dude, are you kidding me? He loves to invent his own fly lines. Oh, yeah.
That's crazy.
That's part of the fun for him, though. Yeah. He enjoys it. He loves fishing, all fishing.
You had a number of guys for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
How important was trying to catch the holy grail fish, the two fish over 200 pounds? Was that the ultimate bar that everybody was looking for?
Well, yeah, what everybody talked about, but I probably never really set my eyes so much on that as that 16-pound record was the one I really wanted to see go away, because Tom and I, and even with Chris, we'd caught so many fish, and more so with Tom, in that ballpark area. I mean,
180-something.
Oh, God, we caught a 176. The next day, we caught a 180 on that supposedly 20, which was 16. And then the next day we hooked this fish that's huge, big fish, beats Tom up from one end to the other, which happens very rarely. Tom's bleeding through his white shorts, big puddle of blood. He's fighting this thing. He's like, well, what do you think? And I'm like, he's big, you know, he's big, but how big is he? We've killed two fish in 2 days and we're not into killing fish,
right?
You know, for no reason. So we'd killed two fish in 2 days, and we're looking at this fish, and we're like, man, I don't know. He's big, though. He ended up breaking off at the boat after an hour and 45 minutes.
That's a long time for you guys.
That's a long, long time for us, and he was big. So, you know, we're like, well, we'll put a release gaff in him.
Yeah.
And then not long after that, that fish that made that, it was the same day that Steve caught that 200-pounder. Some fish came in from the northwest, and we were all kind of lined up.
So wait, let's go back for a second. You put a release gaff on that big fish, but you let him go.
No, he broke off.
Oh, he broke off.
Yeah, okay. We lost him. We never release gaffed that fish.
But you were thinking about taking that fish?
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, if we didn't use a release gaff, I'd just grab them 90% right. of the time and take the hook out of their face and go on right. about our business. But yeah, those fish, the day that Steve caught the 200-pounder, he was directly behind me. And there was a big group of fish coming in through the northwest, and they were kind of out off a place called the High Rack, between the High Rack and the tripod out there. And we threw at them. We didn't get a bite. And Steve was the last boat down there. And he threw at them a couple times, and then he got back around them, and I think he told me he put on this topwater purple-looking thing. And through that, he got that fish to eat. But long story short, that same day, or maybe the next day, we hooked that big fish that was in them pictures.
Yeah.
The one that made all them pictures.
Best photographed in tarpon fishing.
Yes.
Ever.
What was the guy's name? O'Callaghan? What was his name?
Jim Holland Sr.
Jim Holland. Yeah. He took the picture from behind us. Well, that fish, when we got it up close, I said, because we'd been killing some fish, I'm like, dude, let's just make sure. Right. So I reach over to release gaff that fish, and he jumps at the same time and hits me square in the face, dude. Broke my tooth. I had to get a root canal, and he ended up falling off right at the boat after he hit me square in the chops. But I don't know how big that fish was. I probably should have, hindsight, I should have kill gaffed him. But
when he jumped out of the water, he looked like a submarine.
Dude,
a
fish, Polaris fish was big.
Missile.
I should have just kill gaffed it and been done with it. But we were feeling guilty. We wanted to be sure. We didn't want to just kill another fish. We just killed two. Right. You know, which was a lot for us. Right. You know, we've been trying to kill one for 20 years that we couldn't catch.
Right.
You know, that we kept getting close. We're catching these fish that are taping really right in the ballpark and turning them loose. I don't know how many 180-pound tarpon we caught. I have no idea. I can promise you one thing, a bunch. A bunch.
But 180, 185, 187 is so close to 188. But that fish, too, could have been 195.
Absolutely. But so Tom kept looking at me going, they don't make them 190 pounds, you know?
Yeah.
It was like we couldn't get our hands on one. But the day we caught that fish, Tom said, you think he's big enough? I said, I know he's big enough. I'd seen enough. I had a good feeling. We stuck that fish. And on the 12, I told him the same time. I said, that fish is big enough, Tom. I guarantee you. And both of those were, which were fish that we've been chasing forever, you know?
I mean, that record, the 194 and 12, that is just
epic.
Incredible.
Yeah, yeah. People, probably when you think about the anglers like Stu App and all the good anglers over the years that chase that fish, to catch that fish is pretty epic.
Yeah, because 12-pound was a big record, big tippet to chase for a long time. 12-pound
was the tippet.
And I think there, too, that goes back to the Miami rod and reel days where they had a tournament where it was called 12-pound light.
Yes.
No bite tippet.
Right.
So it was just 12-pound to the fly.
Oh, really? I didn't know
yeah,
that.
Oh, yeah. It was called 12-pound really light. Tough. So that 12-pound, I think the aura around 12-pound had really gone back a long time.
Long time.
Yeah. And
that was fly fishing. 12-pound was fly fishing. That's
you couldn't catch them without a bite tippet.
That's fly fishing. That was part of it. Yeah.
Tell me about the 202, that the only fish ever been caught over 200. Tell me about what you know about that fish.
Well, Steve called me and after they'd fought it for a while, and he said, man, this fish looks pretty good. And he said, I think I'm gonna pull it in the boat and tape it. So he called me back and he told me what it was. I said, dude, you got to take him to the hill. It's got to be big enough, you know? It's a big
boat ride.
Boat ride, yeah, yeah. So he did, but like I said in the story, them fish had come out of the Northwest and gone by several of us, and nobody got hooked up. And Steve was at the tail end of the kind of the string, you know? We were spread out, of course, mm-hmm. but the fish were tracking. You had everybody knew. Anybody that knew anything knew where they were coming from.
And you
from.
Guys hooked that really big one the day before, yes. So you had big fish in the
we
house.
We had big fish. It was right in that period of time, in that 10-day period where those big poons were around. So, yeah, he went back around and hooked up, and they caught it, and he called me, and he said, what do you think? And he goes, this fish is bigger than I thought it was, and they took it in, and we went and looked at it, a big poon, you know, big old fat female.
What'd you think when you saw it hanging on that scale?
That was
it was at Malzone's
cool.
house, right?
No.
I saw it hanging from a tree.
Yeah, it was at that year we were all staying in like a fish camp. It was out of control. this lady, she had a place in Arapica. It had like four bedrooms downstairs and a huge loft upstairs with about eight beds in this loft, right? And she had goats running around and you name it, all kinds of chickens and critters. But it was a pretty cool place. It was kind of old school. So we were all staying there, all of us, a lot of us. And even Evans, it was funny. That's where that fish was hanging, right? We were staying in Arapica.
Tell me about Lopez. That
no,
comes to
know,
mind.
I didn't know him.
You didn't know
well.
Him very
no,
well.
No, I never hung out with him. You know,
because I remember Tom saying that there was a beat up old building that was run down, and he went in there, ripped a toilet out of
oh,
the room,
yeah.
and
yeah,
put
I
it
the
on
stories.
The bow
yeah.
of Lopez's yeah. boat. Yeah. The next morning, they're running down the creek there, and Lopez is sitting on that toilet on the bow of his boat.
Oh, we had some crazy times, bro. Like you have no idea.
And that lasted for how long? 20 years?
All the way through the Riverside Villas days and Freddy's days and Billy Knowles. I mean, those guys caught all the fish they wanted to catch. They never had to go past the Chaz River. They stayed right at Black Rock and at the point caught plenty of fish.
But Tom always was talking about seeing them come over the White Sand, Oklahoma Flats.
That was fishing. And they came down there as good as they were anywhere for a lot of years, but they don't do it like they used to. It's almost like you get a handful of days where they come down there and do what they're supposed to, and that's about all you get.
But you still go look and hope to see them.
Oh, yeah. You get a few. You know, you get some, but it's...
How do you... What's the drive that keeps you up in this sacred place, even though there are not very many fish? You haven't seen any really big ones in a long time.
I really want to catch that 8-pound fish. That's
but you can catch that 127.5 almost anywhere. Why go to Homosassa?
Well, that's the place I know the best, and I know they're big enough there. You know, I don't fish the Keys enough to go down there and really compete. You know,
yeah.
I fished a lot. I fished the Gold Cup in 1988 with Clyde.
What was
and
that?
We did really well it was a kill tournament. Yeah.
What was that like for you?
It was fun. We had a great time. We hooked some really good fish, which probably sounds like fish stories, but they aren't. Clyde hooked a really big fish at a place called Channel Key Banks,
which
you probably know it well.
Yeah.
And we fought it for a while. It had to be, in my opinion, you know, 140-pound poon, 130 or 40 pounds, and a Gold Cup's a good one,
mm-hmm.
especially in the 80s. So we get back to the – it ended up breaking off. I'm like, damn, Clyde, what happened? He goes, I got to tell you, I tried a new knot. I'm like, fuck, you got to be kidding me, dude.
All these years.
All the years you tried a new knot and the knot came out. Yeah.
I did
that. Next day he jumps one about 120. He falls off. I'm like, oh, boy. We ended up catching a few small fish back in the back, you know, releases.
But you never wanted to fish that? Again?
The Gold Cup?
Yeah.
Well, I think after that, I'm not sure what year it went to one of them release tournament type deals.
Yeah.
You know?
Then you don't want to do a release tournament.
No, and I didn't really have anybody that wanted to do it. You know?
Did you guys...
I love fishing in the Keys. Keys is awesome.
What does the Gold Cup mean to you guys that were fishing Homosassa? Was that like child's play? Like, who cares? Because you're killing world record fish.
No, not back in the day. Not back in the day when it was, you know, really a great kill tournament, you know, which... Don't kid me, I ain't into killing fish just for something to do, but for a really good tournament, sometimes you got to kill a few fish. I mean, that's just the way it is. And back when it was a kill tournament, it was prestigious. Everybody wanted to really fish in it. It was invitational, and anybody that was really pretty good was going to be there, you know, and anybody that knew anybody was probably going to be there. So to get invited to come fish, it was pretty cool.
Right.
You know, I liked it.
Big invitational.
Yeah, it was good. It was real good. I had a good time.
So you're trying to
I really want to
slide the side that what we did after it became a release tournament, kind of the prestige fell.
Yeah, I mean, you hear all these stories about I caught this and I caught that. I took a picture and I measured this in the water, but
like Tom says,
dude, we are all fishermen. And if you've been fishing long enough, you know, there's a lot of BS that goes on behind the doors. That's just part of fishing.
Well, Tom,
so till you put him on a scale and you fish a tippet the way it was meant to be fished, in my world, nothing counts. That's me personally. Now, I have nothing against those that do it, but for me, I want proof in the pudding. Mm. I want to see it to believe it. I've seen too many fish caught, and people say, oh, that was this or it was that. They ain't even close to that. They have no idea because they've never caught one that big.
Right. You know, I was pulling on scales a lot, trying to figure out what 12 pounds of pressure that fish felt a lot in my hands because I was not catching a lot of fish, but I wanted to learn how to pull quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like if I understand what 12 pounds is here, because you can't put your drag at 12, you're going to break the fish off when he jumps out of the water. So I needed to know what that felt like in my hands.
Yeah.
And so I was in my garage with a scale and a pulley system, pulling 12 pounds of dirt in a bucket, and then I put a 12-pound barbell. I did that a lot. I wanted to know because I wanted to catch a fish quickly. And until you understand how to pull and what actual pressure means, you're not gonna learn quickly because we're not catching as many fish quickly.
Exactly.
And I asked Stu Apt one time. I'm with Stu. I got a scale on the end of his line here.
Mm-hmm.
I said, pull 12. He went right to fucking 12. And he said, and I asked him, I said, how do you know 12 so well? He said, you know how many fish I broke off on 12?
Yeah.
So he learned by catching 12 big fish on 12 and broke so many off.
Oh, yeah.
He learned that way.
Yes.
But I felt like I learned quite well pulling on scales.
Yeah.
But I did it a lot.
We've got to where, I mean, I've caught fish to the boat over 140 pounds in less than 10 minutes on his side, begging to get the hook out of his face. But you got to know when to pull is crucial.
Absolutely.
And you have to understand what the poon's trying to do. Yeah. Until you figure that out.
Because you just can't pull 12 all the time. You're going to break them off.
No.
Right.
No. So, and just pulling don't do it neither.
But at least
they make surges. They make lunges. They turn.
Yeah. But at least knowing what 12 feels like when you actually can get 12. And then obviously you learn what the fish does.
Absolutely.
And it all, the end result is you got to learn in the arena when you're in that battle.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Nobody, I know Tom did. Now, Chris was very good, as we know, casting parking. He was really, really good, but he couldn't get him to the boat very quick. Like a lot of guys couldn't, you know? So he did watch, we made some videos and he watched some of the things Tom was doing, and Chris was a smart guy anyhow. And he picked it up and he cut his fight time probably in half.
What was Tom doing to catch fish so quickly?
He knows when to pull, certainly. And angles. Tom understands angles really good.
But I also too have watched over the years how many guys broke rods, and I know that Tom fought fish, you know, with a pretty high rod,
right? Somewhat
pretty high,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But all that pressure is on his bicep. He's such a strong dude, he can do that.
Yeah.
But most people with a high rod tip, you're just bending the rod tip. You're not putting pressure
you're
on the fish.
Pissing in the wind.
Mm-hmm. But I always saw, you know, the evolution of the game change over the years, once people really started to learn the angles and how to pull. But there was not very many people, I don't think, really learned very well.
Very few people today, you know, can really, really catch a fish in a hurry.
Don't you think that those people can learn a little bit better by trying to figure out what exactly, how much weight they're putting on a fish?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, because people think they're putting 10 pounds of drag on something. You ain't putting 10 pounds of drag for very long. Well, You'd be in a wheelchair.
Well, also, too, when people say you got to pull harder, they just pull back harder.
Yeah,
and bend more of the rod tip.
There's a time to pull and a time you can't pull.
Yeah.
And it's all about breaking their spirit, too. People may think you're crazy, but there is a point to where that poon will take control of you if you let him.
Right.
He gets down and dirty and gets him pecs down, and you think you're hurting him, and he starts doing circles around the boat. You are pissing in the wind. It's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. What do you see for the future of Home Assassin? How much longer what are you, 67 now or so?
Yeah.
How much longer do you want to be up there?
You know, as long as I can fish competitively and I feel good, you know, I'll go as long as I can go. I still don't, you know, people are like, dude, why don't you get up one of them sissy bars to lean up against? Like everybody uses. I'm like, dude, I can't stand up here and hold my balance and pole like I was supposed to.
Right. I'm not doing
that. Then I'm not going to do it.
I totally feel the same. Where does your patience come from when you've gone through all these years of no fish, the decline of the fishery?
Oh, I just think it's my makeup. You know, I've seen it so good, and I know I'll never see it again. And I can't even begin to tell you how many fish I've been involved in catching between Tom and Chris and some of the great anglers I fished. I mean, I have no idea. I have no idea how many poons I've grabbed. It's a bunch.
But I would think that after having caught so many, it's that much harder to stay in there with not as many fish.
It is. But, you know, I got my mind set on trying to catch that 8-pound fish. Tom's trying to do it. Brian's trying to do it.
So you're still
in
the game.
His wife is Helen has turned into a pretty good angler. We've got her going pretty good. And some of them women's records are very vulnerable. I think she can catch them. She's been real close. Mm-hmm. I've hit a couple for her already that would have done it.
Right.
And I didn't get them, which if anybody understands gaffing a tarpon that's fairly green, it's not easy. But she'll only fish 12. If she was fishing 20, it had been done a long time ago. But Brian, her husband, only wants her to learn on 12. So she's fishing. I don't know. I keep trying to get him to fish 16 or 16 is pretty big in the females. So the 20 is small.
Well, break a 20 and then go back to 12.
That's what I keep telling him, but he don't want to listen. So I don't care. You know, I go out there and do the best I can with what I got.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I look at it every day.
Who's the best fisherman you've ever fished with?
Well, the best at catching them is by far Tom.
Right.
There's no comparison. I mean, unbelievably good, unbelievably good. I mean, if I had to say that I learned how to catch them fast, it was from fishing with Tom.
Yeah. But who's the best with the whole package?
Well, probably the best I've ever seen cast and feed them was Chris Parkening.
Yeah.
I'll tell you a story about this guy now. So we're down at Pine Island.
So he's a professional violinist, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Guitarist.
Guitarist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And very good. Very good.
Classical
classical guitar. Yeah. World renowned.
Right.
World renowned. Learned to cast somewhere upstate where they have cliffs. So his back cast is phenomenal. You know, he knows high back cast and stuff. So just he could, if he needed a different angle, he'd walk back to the middle of the boat down the gunwale to change angles to get the right presentation to the fish. And very learned, knew how to feed them, knew that it just wasn't a slow, steady strip. He knew how to watch the fish,
mm-hmm.
let the fish get to the fly, when to bump it, when to strip it. He understood all that. That's why he scored the points he did in the Gold Cup. Guy's good.
Yeah.
And so we're down at Pine Island one day. And my son Brian was with us, and he was younger then, of course, but we're down there and fishing's good. And he hooks up, and he always, when he hooked up, he'd get back into the cockpit so he could give himself more time to bow, to get forward. So he hooks this fish, it comes up, and the line comes up around, as we all know happens, around the butt of the rod, right? Well, he sees that, he's trying to get it off, but the line comes tight and he can't get it off in time. Takes off running in midair, jumps off the bow of the boat, gets the line from around the butt of the rod, lands feet first, catches a poon. That's
fell
pretty.
Off, jumped out the boat.
Jumped off the bow of the boat into the water to have time to get enough slack to get the line off the butt of the rod. That's impressive.
Yeah,
dude. That's pretty good.
That's quick thinking, huh? For sure.
Quick.
What about the sharks now?
Out of control. The whole Gulf Coast is out of control. And that's, I don't blame it on anybody but our marine biologists, because mm-hmm. they will not do any kind of management. And it is out of control from offshore where we fish. Grouper fish, snapper fish, you can't hardly catch them anymore. They get eaten.
Yeah.
And all the way through Bayport is out of control.
You know, the east side too, you talk to an offshore guy, he says 50% of the fish we hook get eaten by sharks. Yep.
Sharks are taking over the whole place. They started in Boca Grande, and those guys have been dealing with it forever, and now we're having to deal with it. Really something terrible at Bayport.
Do you have how many fish a year do you see getting eaten up there?
Well, this past season,
yeah.
We couldn't catch one.
They were getting eaten?
Every single one.
How many fish did you lose?
Gosh, some days five or six, you know.
To sharks?
To sharks. Oh, yeah. Yeah, five or six, one or two. Every time somebody, I mean, Steve this past year had one up in the bushes, and we thought he'll be safe in there. He got eaten in the trees. They lost a big fish in the trees, yeah. But there's no way. I came up with a theory that, all right, if you crank your motors with these four strokes, which we don't like to crank our motors. Even when we hook up, we try to use our trolling motors and not hurt anybody else's fishing. We try to be respectful. But I came up with, okay, if you crank your motor and idle and get right on top of the fish, your chances will increase. You probably won't get eaten. But Steve said this past year he had his motor running and it still got eaten.
Kilpatrick.
Yeah, he said he had that one get eaten right up there inside of Bird Key.
You're basically out there feeding sharks.
Oh, that's all we're doing, bro. Up and down the whole coast.
Have you thought
of it? I mean, I talked to a good friend of mine who fishes in the Everglades. And I don't know, he said they can't carry guns in the park, as you know. So he said they carry bang sticks. Either we can't catch a tarpon down here very often without a shark trying to eat it. So we carry bang sticks.
And the theory is you kill a shark and leave it there on the bottom while the other sharks go away.
Or the other sharks eat it.
Yeah.
I've been seeing that.
You don't want to gaff a fish and get yanked out of the boat anymore.
No. Oh, I would, but you're taking your life in your hands.
Would you now?
Absolutely.
Really?
In a heartbeat.
You're not afraid of getting eaten by a shark?
I am not afraid a bit. No.
Really?
No, I'll fight his ass I ain't going to let him eat me.
But if every fish you're catching now is being lost to shark bites.
Yeah.
And you get yanked out of the boat.
Your chances are about
100%.
Yeah. Yeah. Not 100%.
Every fish you hooked last year got eaten by a shark, you get yanked out trying to catch an 8-pound record.
I wouldn't say everyone. I said there for a little while, everyone we hooked was getting eaten. But You know, we caught some fish that didn't get eaten. Don't get me wrong, but it's bad. It's real bad. Put it this way. I put out a couple of hand lines just to see how bad it was. They weren't in the water for 2 hours. They had bull sharks on them and tiger sharks.
Wow.
Of course, we released the tiger sharks because you're not allowed to kill them.
Mm-hmm.
But the bull sharks, we had a bull shark, a 10-foot bull shark. As soon as he died, four more 10-foot bull sharks came in and ate him. And in the process, a 4-foot bull shark got in the way and they ate him. That's how bad it is. It is out of control. Out of control.
What's terrible. What's the future of the fishery?
There's not going to be a future if they don't do something about it. They're going to have to manage it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, what's the story about the wolves in Yellowstone? And they reintroduced the wolves and they took over and now they're eating the whole place out of house and home.
Yeah.
And it's gotten out of control. Well, that's what's happened with the sharks. You know, it's horrible.
Mullet.
You used to be a commercial fisherman.
Oh, yeah.
A good one.
Yeah. I made a lot of money commercial fishing.
Brian said that you were the bomb mullet fisherman.
Pretty good. But it was like anything else I've done. I worked really hard at it. Yeah. You know, I didn't want to have anybody catch more than me. You know, it drive me crazy.
What was the technique of catching mullet?
Well, back in the day.
Yeah, netting mullet.
Back in the day, we used to gill net them when it was legal.
Right.
And
so you put would you put a net out and wait for them to swim into it, or would you circle a school?
Oh, no,
we
circle strike them.
So what do? You put the net down and run your boat all the way around them?
Yes. Yep. You just take them in, let them hit, and then pick it up.
Your son said it was really exciting.
Oh, it was crazy.
To see him flipping in the net.
Oh, we used to have a ball and make some really good money back in the day. But that's kind of gone away now because the Asians aren't eating the roe anymore like they were.
But they banned the gill netting.
Oh, yeah. That's been banned forever.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Now you can use seine nets, which.
What's a seine net?
A seine net is a 2-inch mesh net that you're allowed 500 square feet of, 4 pieces of it in the water at one time, which basically.
So you just string it one end and it's open. It's not, you don't circle anything. You just leave it there and they swim into it.
Yeah.
Correct?
Well, you have to pull it down on them. You pocket them and then you dip them out because they don't gill off in it.
Right.
Which is okay. But yeah, actually in the gill net days, as long as you went with the size of the fish you were catching, there was really very little damaging bycatch. There's always bycatch in anything you do.
Right.
But it was pretty much limited. But today with these smaller mesh nets that they've introduced, there's actually more bycatch. But if there's a good point in a seine net, you can release it without it getting killed, without it dying. Well, so my motto has always been, if I can catch it and eat it, or I can sell it, I'll kill it. If I can't, I throw it back.
Right.
I mean, at the end of the day, when I'm done bait fishing, I take every white bait out of my bait well and release it. Every little pinfish. That's just the way I've always been.
Right.
But I made a good living for a lot of years selling fish.
Your son said one of the worst hits you took to the head was by a black mullet.
Oh, man, I got smoked. Still got eye damage from it. So we were seine fishing over in Tampa Bay, and it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and we had our good friend, one of Brian's good buddies who played ball, professional baseball.
So you'd fish at night in the dark.
Oh, yeah, fish at night, yeah. So we're pulling down this hard seine, and this kid named Steve Deitch, we call him Bones, was standing behind me, helping me. And fish jumped and hit me square in the eyeball. And I can remember saying to Steve, catch me, I'm going down. So he grabbed me because I'd have drowned, kind of knocked me out.
Out of the boat.
Knocked me, I was waiting, knocked me back, and Steve caught me or I'd have drowned. So long story short, I got up in the boat and I laid down, I couldn't see at all out of that eye. It was just pitch black. So my wife picked me up at 6 o'clock in the morning at the boat ramp when we got in, took me straight to a place called the Eye Institute. And they examined my eye, which was totally closed. And they said, we don't see any permanent damage, but you're not going to be able to see for a while. So I couldn't see for about 10 days. And then just this past year, I had to have surgery in it from scar tissue.
This last year?
Yeah, this past year, it caught up to me.
Did it affect your vision on the flats?
Big time. But I can see good enough with one eye, dude. That's what Brian Tang told me. My dad, he said, dude, you're half blind in one eye and you still see better than anybody else. It was funny.
What kind of glasses did you always wear? I think it was kind of a yellow copper, wasn't it? On the flats?
The brand that I wear now?
No. Well, in general, when you're out there in the flats.
Oh, amber. Yeah, I wear amber.
Like a lighter color.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, my son, he still likes to wear dark. He says the contrast is better for him. So it depends on
who you are and what you like better.
But you're talking about somebody that used to hit 100 mile an hour fastballs.
Yeah.
I see pretty good.
Did you ever have any aspirations to fish offshore?
I did.
But like marlin and stuff like that?
Oh, no. I've never marlin fished in my life.
Billfish?
No. No.
Bottom fish, little grouper stuff.
I did all that.
Yeah.
I had a 42-foot Dorado, which was a commercial grouper boat, which I had a blast in. But the regulations and keeping up with everything and trying to get enough fish to be allowed to catch to stay in business got out of hand. The IFQ programs are terrible. Our fisheries people have no clue how to manage the fishery in Florida. Unfortunately, it's terrible. I mean, people are sitting at home that own the fishing shares and they don't even own a boat, but yet they can lease them to the fishermen who are doing the work and make more money than the fishermen are making. But as long as NOAA...
That's a permit that they have.
They have a reef permit to go catch the fish.
Yeah.
But in order to go catch the fish, you have to own shares, which is like the stock market. So the people that own the shares lease the quota out to the fishermen. And the share price is higher than most of the fish prices. So if you have say for instance, right now, I talked to the girl at the fish house the other day, a gag grouper, say $8, right? So if it's $8, it's going to cost the fisherman to lease the shares from the owner $4 at least. So if he pays him $4 and then he gets $4, the guy sitting at home is making all the money. You're not burning any gas. You don't own a boat.
So your only fishing work is pole fishing now.
Oh yeah,
fly fishing.
Yeah.
What do you do in the off season besides your race car?
Play with boats a little bit. I build a few boats still. Yeah. Do some paint jobs.
Tell me about
basically what I want to do.
Yeah. Tell me about your drag racing. I there's a photograph where you almost flip a car.
Oh, I love going fast. I guess you might say it's an expensive hobby. Somebody sent me a picture that says, "Can drag racing make you a millionaire?" And then a quote is, "Yeah, only if you were a billionaire." So it's a bad hobby, expensive hobby. But yeah, I like it. And I've backed off a little bit here recently. But I raced motorcycles and then I raced cars.
What kind of drag race motorcycles?
Yeah, I got a couple of drag race motorcycles.
You would have loved downhill ski racing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Is there anything that you'd like to talk about that we haven't mentioned and covered?
No, maybe just the one thing that probably bothers me a little bit is I don't like to hear about people screaming at other people with, you know, obscenities and abusing people because they want to fish in a certain area. I'm not going to name names or places, but any person that wants to fish has the right to fish anywhere they want to as long as they abide by the rules, meaning that if you have a sandbar that you're staked out on and somebody gets behind you and they're courteous, there's no reason to go scream at that person because they've showed up in a place that you call home. If a person shows up in Homosassa, and I've been there for over 45 years, they are more than welcome as long as they play by the rules.
So you're talking about spot ownership possibly?
Yes. I don't believe in that. I don't think it's right. And I don't think people should abuse other people for wanting to go fishing.
Even though they may have gotten to where you like to fish first.
I don't care. You don't own that spot.
Right.
That is God's country. If you're there on Monday and you're not there on Tuesday and that person wants to fish there, then they should be allowed to fish there.
How do you feel?
If you're there first, that person better not get in front of you. Or cut you off.
Yeah, cut you off.
That's not right.
Yeah, it's almost, if you're down light and the fish are down light, you don't go there. What about if somebody sees you fishing a spot and you see him run by and stop and get out his binos and sees you there and then all of a sudden he's there the next day?
That's a little much. I mean, that can rub me a little raw, especially bait fishing.
Yeah, so how do you deal with that?
How I've dealt with it in the past is I've told several people that I know don't know where to fish, "Hey man, you know what? I'd like it if I don't see you here tomorrow, you know, if I'm coming there."
But he would say too to you, well, you can't, you don't own that spot.
No, and he's right. I don't. But I would frown a little more on that if somebody tried to squeeze me and I couldn't get in there.
Right.
But I'm talking about mostly if a person is not exactly fishing in your spot, but near it. Okay. Like if somebody's in the number one spot and you were there yesterday and a guy comes in and gets behind you and you go scream at him because he's a newcomer, I don't think that's cool.
Yeah.
You know? I don't think somebody should do that.
Yeah.
But now somebody's stealing your spot and trying to race you to it and you know they're deliberately doing that. Now that's another issue.
Right.
Then, but still at that point, you go talk to them first.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to threaten them and cuss at them and scream at them. You can simply have a discussion with them and tell them, look, we're not going to put up with that.
Mm-hmm.
And we run into the same thing at Bayport, at Home Sass. I run into the same thing out here. I mean, just like I told you earlier with the jet ski guy. I mean, he'd come in there. He didn't know any better. I mean, it happened this past year. He had his kid with him. And I'm looking at my client. I'm like, I'm not going to yell at this guy, dude. He don't know any better.
Right. He doesn't
know. You tell him, go back out the other way. Don't run through that pack of boats through Black Rock. I said, you're going to get people yelling at you.
Mm-hmm. You know? Let's talk of records. One more question about the records. Which record are you most prideful of?
16.
Beating 16. The 188 Billy
Pace record.
And why is that?
Just because it took us 20 years to the day, I guess. You know, and I know that was the top-notch record for a long, long time.
That was the most fit. That
Billy Pate's record, you know, that was it. Even though the 12 is tougher, and it's probably a better record, but
16 was more famous?
16, to me, was the one I wanted to get the worst.
Yeah.
Well, plus, we tried for so long, and we got so close.
Right. 20 years, yeah.
Yeah.
What do you, if you take a look at your body of work as a whole, what are you most proud of?
Oh, man. Probably my work ethic. My work ethic and my loyalty, you know?
Yeah.
I try to be as loyal as I can, you know, with my customers. They're good to me. I'm good to them. I don't never, very rarely will you hear me yell at a customer or degrade them or, you know.
They're trying hard.
Oh, and with Tom, you never had to say nothing to Tom because he'd take care of himself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he would scream at himself. And that's probably what made him so good because I've had doctors on the boat that couldn't admit they were wrong. You know, not Brian Tang. He's very good at admitting he's wrong. But other doctors in the past, they couldn't see that, boy, I screwed that up. And that's probably the most important thing you can do if you want to get better. If you can't realize you just screwed that up, you screwed that cast up or you set the hook when you shouldn't have, or, you know, you didn't pay attention, you didn't bow, you weren't on target. You know, that's part of it.
Yeah.
But I never scream at people. I don't cuss at my customers or scream at them, or I have nothing to prove, really. You know, I do my job. It's their responsibility to do theirs.
How would you like to be remembered and known?
Just a nice guy.
Cool.
That's it. That's all I care about.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're a good dude. I love you.
Good.
No one knows Al DePerrick better than Tom Evans, who's fished with Al for over four decades. And when I ask him how he feels about Al, he says he's just the best. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you want to see more content or behind the scenes, please follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. We'll see you again soon. Just so right.